Hello and welcome to the Doctor Family podcast. Thanks for your growing support, and if you're new to the show, please join the family. The subject of today's podcast was chosen by one of our listeners who got in touch with us via our website, thedoctorfamily.com. The subject of today's podcast is osteoarthritis. Osteoarthritis has a lifetime risk of about 85%, and it causes pain and significant disability to millions of people worldwide. As soon as Nina and I heard that this topic had been requested, we immediately thought of today's guest. We first met Mark Latimer as students in Cambridge, where he was lecturing on this very topic. Mr. Mark Latimer is a consultant orthopaedic surgeon who's an honorary lecturer at the University of Cambridge and a senior honorary lecturer at the University of Leicester. In today's podcast, we look at what's known of the causes of osteoarthritis, along with the treatments that are available to us at the moment, and we discuss the need for further research into osteoarthritis. We also touch on some of the various surgical options there are for managing it. As always, when two medics are talking shop, sometimes a few words slip through which might be unfamiliar to our audience. I've tried to capture as many of them as possible and have put them into a glossary on our webpage for today's podcast. If there are any that I've missed, please do get in touch and I'll do my best to put a translation along with those I've already found. Something that I've been asked by a lot of my patients, and actually I realised more and more as I'm practicing medicine, that I'm very apt to say when someone has a hurty hip and their x-ray shows degenerative changes that they may have a bit of wear and tear arthritis, but I don't really know an awful lot about what's going on, what's the disease process there. I wondered if you might be able to enlighten me a little bit.
Well, you're not alone, David. Although it is a very, very common pathological process. In fact, the Americans published that 85% of the population will have asymptomatic osteoarthritis at some stage in their lives. And when they say symptomatic, they actually define that as meaning a functional limitation. The disease process is not terribly well understood. We do know that it's not simply a process of wear and tear, because actually you can get into your 9th and 10th decades without really very much sign of osteoarthritis at all. And actually, as a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, but also as a general orthopedic surgeon on the trauma rota, I rather sadly take out the femoral heads of 90-year-olds once or twice a year, which look like snooker cue balls. They're beautiful, shiny white, and you know, look very similar to the hip of a 20-year-old. And you may wonder why. That's, of course, for the intracapsular femoral neck fractures, where we know if we don't replace the femoral head, the fracture won't unite and the head will crumble and die. But it is a remarkable thing to see resilient 90-year-olds with barely any arthritis at all. And at the other end of the spectrum, if you look at the hips of Eamon Holmes, who's published his hip x-rays before he underwent hip surgery, a man in his mid-50s has total loss of joint space and bone deformity. And there are some things we know are very significant risk factors for osteoarthritis, and we do know something about the pathological process. But you're right in your original assertion that to regard it simply as wear and tear disease is too simple.
So we obviously know that it's not purely wear and tear, although I remember from your lecture that I attended all those years ago that injury can predispose one to having osteoarthritic changes later on in life. And we often see what we call the footballer's knees, the guys who played a lot of sort of football getting osteo.
I like to break osteoarthritis down into a primary pathology and a secondary pathology. So there's no doubt at all that there are a whole panoply of different insults to the articular surface of synovial joints, which then lead to an accelerated arthritic process. And the commonest would almost certainly be a post-traumatic osteoarthritis. Knees are a classic example. You have a severe meniscal tear or you have a subchondral fracture, which is a relatively new phenomenon. It's something which doesn't show up on an x-ray but does show up on an MRI scan. You have intra-articular cartilage damage of some sort, which then leads to an accelerated osteoarthritis. And Other classic examples are things like infection in the joint, but also bleeding into the joint. In worst case scenario, in something like haemophilia, where you get recurrent haemothrosis, then that causes damage. But those are regarded as the secondary osteoarthritis. And of course, sorry, the other big group is actually is rheumatoid arthritis or the inflammatory arthropathies. Just when our rheumatology colleagues feel they've really got the inflammatory components of the disease under control with anti-TNF-alpha drugs, then actually we see a post-rheumatoid progression into remorseless osteoarthritis take its place, which is rather miserable. I'm always delighted by the upbeat spirit of rheumatoid patients. In fact, that's actually even been published as a sort of slightly incongruous positive outlook. But just as their inflammatory disease is controlled, then actually they get osteoarthritis too. In the primary osteoarthritis group, well, we do know that mechanical wear and tear does play some part. There's quite a lot of literature associating osteoarthritis with professions which are regarded as imposing a regular high impact and therefore potentially damaging insult onto the joints. Construction workers, scaffolders, farmers get more lower limb osteoarthritis. Actually, people who do a lot of kneeling, so people who lay tiles on the roof or who lay carpet, they get patellofemoral knee osteoarthritis. People who use, I'm not sure we even use them anymore, partly for this reason, but pneumatic drills to dig up the road give you wrist and thumb-based osteoarthritis. And, you know, there are many papers which do demonstrate that association between excessive mechanical load and usually load repetitive impact that seem to predispose to osteoarthritis.
That's an interesting one, because we often, you know, we're aware, as you described, that injuries which go into the joint itself, so fractures that go into the joint or damage to the cartilages within the joint or bleeds or infection within a joint, all seem to trigger some sort of process which leads to this osteoarthritic change that we see. You also mentioned the repetitive strains of certain professions that might impact on this. How about things like running? So these marathon runners, people are doing lots and lots of miles. Because the other side of the coin is that that's supposed to be very protective from osteoporosis, so the thinning of the bones.
Well, that's a very interesting question, and as you can imagine, is a relatively difficult question to interrogate with a randomized controlled trial, because age is the most strongly correlated risk factor with osteoarthritis. The second most strongly correlated risk factor is obesity. And in order to do the trial that you are proposing, you need to find 100 marathon runners, and age, gender, BMI match them with 100 people who don't run. And the truth is that people who don't run, or people who do run, generally have a low BMI, and to match them with the inactive, you will largely have a group who have a high BMI. But it has been done. They did a study in Finland looking at road running, and actually that demonstrated that physical activity in the absence of injury is protective of joints, or at least doesn't cause damage. The evidence actually is that almost certainly physical activity such as running is protective of the hips. It's a bit equivocal on knees, but certainly doesn't actually cause any significant damage. And so the balance of risks and benefits is certainly in favour of exercise.
Okay, that's good to hear, although I probably don't do as much as I'd like. We've talked about injury, we've talked about the exercise. Other lifestyle factors that may affect the risk of people developing osteoarthritis in certain joints. I seem to remember from a lecture that you gave a long time ago, for example, squatting being particularly helpful, if I'm correct, in hip.
Well, yes, we don't know. That's an attempt to try and understand how different races from around the world have very significantly different rates of osteoarthritis. And certainly Southeast Asia has dramatically less osteoarthritis than, for instance, the United States. But as people migrate from one side of the world to the other, they don't acquire entirely the arthritis risk of their destination country, but they do start to acquire something of the arthritis risk of their destination. So very specifically, Southeast Asians who travel to the States start to get more arthritis. And that seems to be independent of BMI, and therefore it's never been actually trialed in any formal way. But the suggestion is that, that there are lifestyle differences. And the biggest one that's obvious in terms of hip and knee stresses and strains would be the decision to squat rather than to sit in a chair when you eat snack food in the street. But we don't know.
I guess the only other thing that occurred to me while I was hearing you talking about the 90-year-olds who have these pristine hip joints, even if sadly the neck of their femur has been broken, and I guess that probably risks blood supply to the head of the femur, which won't do well. But has there been much research done looking at the common factors in these people whose hips are beautifully preserved?
There aren't any very clear unifying factors. So when you take out the risk factors that we've already touched on, so obesity, physical activity, there are a very small number of patients who actually have arthritis, which is really related to single gene defects, but represents only 2% of the population. The other risk factor is the sort of the polygenic inheritance, and we do know that node positive arthritis by the age of 50 confers a 2- or 3-fold increased risk on your first degree relatives. So arthritis does run in families, and we see that, but we don't see other clear epidemiological features in the people who seem not to get osteoarthritis. But by their nature, the 90-year-olds tend to have lived fairly healthy lives. They're often not terribly heavy, and they don't have any other medical problems largely. But whether that is causal, I don't know.
Mark, what research is going on into the causes and treatment of osteoarthritis at the moment?
So again, I mean, orthopedic surgeons and rheumatologists both would suggest that, as I say, a disease process which has a lifetime risk of about 85% attracts less than 2% of Medical Research Council funding. And some might imagine that is a little bit skewed. There's plenty of scope for research. And I think actually, certainly in Cambridge, David, you I'm sure remember when you were in Cambridge, there wasn't a formal tenured chair in orthopaedics. There now is. There's a wonderful chap called Andrew McCaskey, who is one of the world's leading experts on cartilage regeneration technologies. And so we're starting to attract a little bit more funding to support the treatment of what is for a very large part of the population often a very functionally restrictive disease.
I think that's very exciting for the future, although I hope it doesn't do you out of your day job.
Well, I don't see it as an imminent threat
to your livelihood. No, I think that's fair. The other thing that I always get asked by patients, and I suspect you do as well, green-lipped muscle, glucosamine, chondroitin.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Any other dietary changes that could be made to improve the osteoarthritis?
So I'm sure you know perfectly well. So if you look at NICE guidelines, if you go to the Cochrane database, there is very, very little evidence for any of those treatments. The ones which possibly have some therapeutic benefit are glucosamine sulfate, but taken at quite a high dose, at a dose. So the Cochrane database, I think, currently recommends 1.5 grams daily. It doesn't do any of the things we'd like it to do, like actually slowing the degenerative process, but it does appear for a proportion of patients who take it, it does appear to be as effective as simple first-line analgesia without the side effects. And the other one is glucosamine. Now, glucosamine has developed a slightly bad reputation because it is used commercially to inject into knees. It's not licensed by the NHS. It's not available as an NHS therapy. And that reflects the fact that it is quite expensive and not terribly effective. But having said that, there are some trials which again demonstrate that in a well-chosen population, injecting glucosamine, which is one of the components of cartilage into knees, is helpful. Every orthopaedic surgeon who practices hyaluronic acid injections will tell you about patients of theirs who come back time and time again because of its magical properties. When it's actually submitted to trials, it's borderline.
That brings me nicely onto the next big subject I wanted to cover, which was, okay, these patients have developed a painful joint. We've examined it, we've x-rayed it, we've shown that it's got this osteoarthritic change. What are our treatment options at that point? Because certainly it's been traditional that we've been asked in general practice to give people painkillers, and then we get shouted at by another group of the profession that painkillers are devil's work and they're going to cause all sorts of problems. So what genuine options do we have for these people?
Yes, well, that's a very good question. So there is some evidence for physiotherapy. There's evidence that actually regular low impact repetitive mobility exercises which maintain muscle tone and keep the joints mobile and active does have some useful therapeutic benefit. There is also good evidence for some of the more occupational therapy interventions like using walking sticks and that sort of thing. Actually, orthotics and other kind of walking aids can help to offload particularly a painful hip. And in a past life before doing medicine, I did engineering, and you can do some quite elegant static equilibrium equations which show that if you put a walking stick in the opposite hand from the hip, you can reduce the joint reaction force, the force actually transmitted across the hip, by about a third. And for some people, that is very effective. And so I do think treatment of osteoarthritis is a multidisciplinary treatment, and getting our therapy colleagues involved is very useful. But actually, our therapy colleagues are very astute. If a physiotherapist tells me they don't feel physiotherapy is going to be very helpful, then they're pretty likely to be right. And so I do sometimes feel that when care commissioning groups ask for patients to have had evidence of a year's physiotherapy, that sometimes is somewhat misdirected. But I recognise that physiotherapy has its role. And then beyond the, as you say, things like glucosamine, the injection therapies, hyaluronic acid, I don't use it, but colleagues do. There is an inevitable sort of surgical escalation hierarchy, and that's a little bit joint dependent. But if we think about knees, there is some pretty robust evidence for the use of knee arthroscopy in well-selected cases, people who have mechanical symptoms and have well-localized pain with, for instance, degenerative meniscal tears evidenced by MRI scanning, where actually there is evidence for a useful therapeutic.
So this is the keyhole surgery.
Keyhole surgery. But that has to be set against some very good studies and some rather interesting studies which refute the benefit of keyhole surgery and osteoarthritis. And my favourite is the New England Journal article from 2002, which is usually referred to as the Veterans Study. It's a study which got ethical approval in the United States. I'm not sure they would get ethics approval here. It was a true double-blinded randomised controlled trial for knee arthroscopy. So there's 180 patients recruited to the trial, and they either went to the active treatment arm, had knee arthroscopy, debridement, lavage, or they went to the dummy arthroscopy trial, where they went to theatre, they had a general anaesthetic, they had a tourniquet put on the leg, they had incisions made at the front of the knee. The surgeon and the anaesthetist then twiddled their thumbs for 30 minutes. The surgeon stitched up the knee, went back to the recovery, clearly not knowing which branch of the trial they're in, and then were followed up by independent observers. No difference between the two groups.
That is always difficult to continue arguing for a treatment when there is evidence out there like that. The other treatment that we often try in general practice, and I think there's some similar variability in the data for, is steroid injection into, for example, knees.
Yes. As a surgeon, I do, of course, recognize the role of steroids. Steroids are effective. They often don't have quite as long-term effect as we would like. The downside of steroid injections is that there is unequivocal evidence that they increase your infection rate if you then proceed to joint replacement at a later stage. And the infection in joint arthroplasty is such a devastating outcome that I would limit the use of steroids to, you know, the minority of cases. I think if you know that you're heading for a joint replacement, well, actually, you're going to be better off gritting your teeth and mitigating the infection risk rather than using steroids as a bridge to joint replacement.
Is there any evidence on how long that effect is persistent for? So if someone had a six-month gap, say, after a steroid injection, is there still that increased risk of infection?
A six-month gap takes it down to negligible. But yes, you're right. It is a time-dependent effect. We do know that the risk actually falls to a negligible level over about 4 to 6 months.
Okay.
Talking about different treatments for different joints, there are several joints where we do know there is a useful benefit for arthroscopy, and my foot and ankle colleagues can demonstrate the efficacy of ankle arthroscopy. My upper limb, hand and shoulder surgery colleagues will show you equally the benefits of wrist scopes and shoulder scopes. There is evidence that in the hands of well-trained, high-volume experts, that hip arthroscopy can be effective. But my advice to you as a GP is don't refer for arthroscopy without a sound knowledge of your local surgeon's numbers and expertise, because in the hands of the have-a-go arthroscopist, it's technically challenging and hugely ineffective. And then after arthroscopy, again, joint-dependent, there are quite a lot of different techniques to employ. I think naturally do think about joint replacements, and for the hip is likely to be the best option. In fact, hip replacement surgery has been described as the operation of the decade. American Orthopaedic Academy regard it as the most cost-effective surgical intervention. It works. It's the great thing about hip replacement surgery is that, and actually the great thing about the pioneering work done by John Charney and Wrightington in the 60s, is that he developed a prosthesis and a technique which changed a bit over the years. But actually, even in the hands of a relatively inexperienced surgeon, get good results. And that's a testament not to the surgeon, but it is a testament to the operation. It's a good operation. It's a very forgiving operation most of the time. Elsewhere in the body, there are a lot of other alternatives, particularly which you would wish to consider in the younger patient. And that's rather joint dependent. In the foot and ankle, often arthrodeses, fusing joints, are very effective. People with ghastly big toe arthritis who really struggle to walk more than 100 yards because of pain in the base of the big toe, fusing that joint has very little in the way of functional impact and takes the pain away permanently and with any of the risks of trying to put a prosthetic joint in there. Hand surgeons still would routinely practice excision arthroplasty surgery, so taking out bones that are very arthritic. Commonest site of functionally limiting osteoarthritis in the upper limb is thumb base, the joint between the thumb metacarpal and the trapezium. And actually just taking the trapezium out is a very, very good way of taking the pain away. It makes the thumb a bit weaker, but it's pretty good if you're not needing a lot of power in your thumb.
When I'm looking at orthopedics and the surgery that you perform on our patients with the osteoarthritis, often it seems to be for the pain, and it's very effective for the pain for a lot of people. But the hips, really, the function is amazing. And I think the latest that everyone would have seen and heard is seeing Andy Murray have a resurfacing operation and then getting back out and playing competitive tennis again.
Yes, it was very interesting to the orthopaedic community. Firstly, that he chose to have his surgery done in the UK, which was very good. He's previously always gone to a chap called James O'Donnell in Melbourne. And so he chose Sarah Muirhead Allwood, who is a fabulous London-based hip surgeon. And, well, I suspect she's now most famous for having operated on Andy Murray. But before she operated on Andy Murray, she was also famous for being the royal orthopaedic surgeon and had operated on the Queen Mother. She's a brilliant surgeon. She did a brilliant job. And she clearly gave Andy Murray what was exceptionally good advice for his circumstances, but which probably shouldn't necessarily be extrapolated to people who are not 30-something extreme athletes, because we do know, so there are lots of conceptual benefits in hip resurfacing rather than hip replacement. You take less bone at the first operation. The bigger head is much less likely to dislocate, and if it does dislocate, it normally just pops back in on its own. But there have been very significant problems with the Birmingham hip resurfacing, and that centres both around the systemic metal iron risks, but actually also the local metal iron risks. For the right people, and I'm sure Andy Murray was very well advised to have a resurfacing. For the right people, they're wonderful, do brilliantly well. People tell you within 6 months it feels just like a normal hip. I forget I've ever had an operation and all the pain's gone, and that's great. But for women, for the older men over 65, for smaller people, for people whose femoral head has a diameter of less than 44 millimetres, there seem to be increased risks. You have to be very cautious in the consent process for hip resurfacing. As you say, right thing for Andy Murray, not the right thing for everyone.
So, Mark, what's changed for you in hospital as a result of the COVID crisis? We've had to make quite a few changes in practice.
We've changed practice a lot, as I'm sure we have in general practice. We're doing lots and lots of remote clinics. We're trying to make the emergency department management a one-stop shop. So the orthopaedic consultants have done a kind of back to the floor, running the minor injuries unit and stitching up cuts, but also managing fractures, hopefully in a way that doesn't require a return to the hospital. So everybody gets ideally a soft cast, caster cast they can take off themselves at home. They don't need to come back for a conversion of a back slab to a cast and then back for a third time. And lots of other examples. You know, we're using lots more walking boots and lots more wrist splints and things which don't require a second trip to the hospital. And those things were the things we've actually pushed for years, and they're now becoming standard practice, and they will continue after lockdown, I've no doubt at all.
So on that silver cloud, I'd just like to say thank you very much indeed for taking the time to speak to me again today.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure as always, and I'd love to come back to you to focus a bit more on your subspecialty of paediatric
orthopedics. I would be absolutely delighted. Thank you very much for the invitation. I've very much enjoyed it.
I hope you've enjoyed today's show. If you are affected by osteoarthritis and want to find out more, please do check out the charity for all types of arthritis, Versus Arthritis, the website of which will be linked to in our show notes. They also fund a lot of the research going on into this and other types of arthritis, and please do consider supporting them to help them with the research that we've heard is so desperately needed. We will be played out, as always, by the fabulous music of Drew Worthley. If you've enjoyed today's show, please do help us grow it by sharing it with any of your friends who you think might enjoy it. Join us on Facebook or our webpage and get involved. Subscribe in your podcast software and join us for the next episode. See you next time.
Guevara is on my coaster, his wreath in gold stars, his revolution's a sad face. Now he wonders how he wound up here.